Well, we live in a culture where we don't have to worry about that so much, a time in history where we're not really worried about being the prey of some predator. It would be hard to live life like that. You can't even enjoy your nice day because you might suddenly get surprised by something that just eats you and kills you. And it's one of those things where, you know, even in our modern culture, we still have predators that we don't always think about that way. But we have viruses, they're living things trying to kill us in many ways. We have parasites, some parasites will kill you if you don't catch it, and they sneak up and you can't see them because they're inside. There's even sort of things that are like predators because of our modern society, radiation, toxins, that enough exposure, you don't see them, but enough exposure, they can ruin your nice day. And the Bible tells us that there are also spiritual predators in our spiritual world, a spiritual world that we don't always think about because we don't see it. But Genesis 4 shows us a certain kind of predator, a certain kind of spiritual predator that is so sneaky and creeps up and crouches up and is so insidious that it actually hides inside our faith in God. It's a very ancient story. It goes all the way back to Genesis, the fourth chapter of the Bible, Genesis chapter 4. We're just going to look at verse 1 and 5 right now. It says that Adam made love to his wife Eve, and she became pregnant and gave birth to Cain. She said, "With the help of the Lord, I have brought forth a man." Now, back in those days, way thousands of years back, when women gave birth, they gave birth to a man. 5 o'clock shadow, full mouth of teeth, brushy eyebrows, all that. It's kind of strange, but that's what the Bible says, so we're going to believe it. No, I'm kidding. That's a figure of speech, obviously, for theological reasons we're not going to get into now. But, verse 2, later she gave birth to his brother Abel. Now, Abel kept flocks, and Cain worked the soil. That will be important to the story. In the course of time, Cain brought some of the fruits of the soil as an offering to the Lord, and Abel also brought an offering, fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flock. The Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but on Cain and his offering, he did not look with favor. So Cain was very angry, and his face was downcast. Now, if you're just looking at the two people, the two brothers, looking at their offering, they have a lot in common. Both of them have faith in God. They have faith in God enough to bring an offering to God, a sacrifice to God, but one of them God accepts. Literally in the Hebrew, that means one of them God sees the sacrifice, and the other one God did not see it, didn't even notice it. One of them God accepts, and the other one God rejects. And the question is, you know, why? What's the difference? I mean, it's really hard to read in the story. What's the difference between the two? Now, if you believe, if you're somebody who believes the Bible is true or might be true, and if you're at all sensitive to what it means to have a life that you're acceptable to God, if you're at all sensitive to the idea of where you stand with God, then you probably should have an answer or try to have an answer at least. Why was one acceptable to God and the other one rejected by God? It would be sort of like, if we put it in the context of here, we have two people coming to church, or in the case of today, 3,000 people coming to church, and on the outside, you kind of look, and most of them are all doing the same thing. Most of them are, well, coming to church, which is not easy. I mean, there's a lot of other things to do, but here it is, you came to church on a Sunday morning, coming to church to, many ways, maybe serve or sing songs of praise and worship, and maybe an offering you give, and maybe during communion you come forward, and if you look around, everybody's kind of doing the same thing, and yet at the end of the day, it turns out some God accepted that, and they have a standing with God, and others God rejected. And you're asking, well, why? What's the difference? Looking at the outside, they're all kind of doing the same thing. And that's what happens to Cain and Abel in Genesis chapter 4. So what's the difference between Cain's offering and Abel's offering? Some have suggested that, well, the difference is that Abel brought a blood sacrifice, and Cain just brought vegetables. And the reason why they say that that's a big deal is because later in the Old Testament, God's going to command the Israelites to bring an offering for their sin. It's called an offering for atonement, and that's going to have an animal sacrifice, a blood sacrifice. But there's a lot of Hebrew words for sacrifice, for offering in the Old Testament. The Old Testament was written in ancient Hebrew that just gets translated in English as offering, but there's a lot of different Hebrew words. And the specific Hebrew word that's used here is not an atonement offering. It's not an offering for atonement or sin. It's specifically an offering that's called a dedication offering. What's a dedication offering? Well, a dedication offering is where you take something that you have that's of value to you and you give it to God as the sign, as a symbol of you're giving your life to God. It's a sign of your trust and your allegiance to him. And it says that both Cain and Abel made this dedication offering to God for what they have. I mean, all that you give what you have. Cain worked the soil, so he had fruits of the soil. Abel had livestock, so he brought livestock. But later in the New Testament, thousands of years later, at least a couple, maybe over 1,000 years later, it looks, I mean, at the time of the writings, I don't mean the time of the story. The story goes back thousands of years. The author of Hebrews reflects back on this story we're reading of Cain and Abel and says in Hebrews 11, chapter 11, verse 4, by faith, Abel brought God a better offering than Cain did. By faith, he was commended as righteous when God spoke well of his offering. So Hebrews 11 says it was a better offering. God spoke well of his offering, just like we saw in the chapter. God looked upon his offering and accepted it, but Cain's he rejected. Well, what made Abel's offering a better offering? Not because it was a blood sacrifice. We got that clear. What made it better was that it was, according to Hebrews 11, given by faith. We might say given by the right kind of faith. Both of them had faith enough to give God. They believed in God. We might say it was given by the right kind of faith. And if you actually look at the story, if we actually pay attention to what the wording was, if we look closely, we do notice that what it says is that Abel gave fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flock. That word firstborn is really important because this is Abel's livelihood. It's not like if something goes south, he can just go down to Walmart and buy some food. This is his livelihood, and it's a risk because, see, you're hoping that the season's going to be a good season. You're going to have babies. You're going to have a flock at the end of the season, but you're not really sure. It's not as if what he did is say, well, you know, let's kind of wait and see. Let's see how big the flock gets. What is it we need now to do well here? And okay, I guess we've done well enough. Let's see, I can spare one. Let's give one to God. How about that one over there? That's a little one. Let's give that one to God. That's not what he did. What he did was, before any of that happened, before he had a chance to see how anything was going to turn out with his livestock, he gives the first one that was born to God. That's an act of faith, like Hebrews says. That's why Hebrews 11 says that Abel gave to God out of faith. Faith in what? Well, faith in God. Faith in the sense of the synonymous with the word trust. Trust in who God is. Trust that he might have thought like this, if everything comes from God, and if God has promised to take care of me, then I can give God the firstborn as a sign of my trust and a sign of my allegiance to him over anything else. By faith means that he knew that the God who created everything is infinitely greater, infinitely better than anything else. Infinitely more satisfying, infinitely more trustworthy, infinitely more secure. Now that was different than the attitude that Cain had. It just says that Cain just brought some fruits of the soil. The Cain sees his offering more as kind of making a transaction with God. You know how a transaction is. If I give this, then God will give me something in return. So in a transaction, you try to give as little as you can that counts. Little as you can that's going to get you credit so that you get in return what you want. And so, yes, Cain had a certain kind of faith, no doubt. He believed in God. He believed in God enough to make an offering of something from his soil, from a fruit of his soil. It's a sacrifice. But he did it in a way that kind of shows that just some fruit of the soil. It's the kind of faith in God, a belief in God, but it's not really a trust in God. In fact, he's a little bit suspicious of God. He's a little bit suspicious, so because all he really wants is a kind of credit with his sacrifice so that God will bless him with something in return. God will give him something in return. If I do this, if I give God this, then he'll do something for me. Now, we know that was his attitude because of the next verse. It says that after we know that God rejected his gift, it says in verse 5, so Cain was very angry, and his face was downcast. He wasn't broken. He wasn't humbled. He wasn't repentant of anything. He was angry. You get angry when you think you've paid money for something, but you didn't get what you paid your money for. That's when you get angry. It's in Cain's mind, he's sacrificing his vegetables, whatever, because he expects God to see that as something that would give him credit and that God will give him something in return. And when God doesn't, in Cain's mind, God just stole his vegetables. He paid, but he got nothing. You get that, right? I mean, it's a bummer. What a bummer to make a sacrifice to God and not get any credit for it. You did something for God, and now you think you deserve for God to do something for you, but no, nothing. Has that ever happened to you? I mean, have you ever looked around and said, you know what? I'm kind of, compared to other people, doing a lot. I'm honest. Well, compared to most, I'm honest. I try to live my life within good moral boundaries. I mean, compared to most, I make sacrifices to live my life within certain moral boundaries. I go to church. Now, here you are. Here we are. I give what I can. More than most, I bet. And yet, God is not giving me what I want. In fact, I do all this, and my life has gotten even worse. In fact, I do all this, and things seem to get worse the more I do. And then I look around, and I start to notice that all these other people that have zero commitment to God whatsoever are doing just fine. You ever think that way? That's why Cain got angry with God. He made this sacrifice, and it was for sure a sacrifice, and he thought he deserved God's blessing, and he didn't get it. He didn't understand what Abel understood, that the God who created everything is infinitely greater, infinitely better than anything else, infinitely more trustworthy, infinitely more satisfying, and infinitely more secure. But a Cain kind of faith, a transactional kind of faith, if I give God this, he'll give me that kind of faith, will never ever be satisfied in life, especially ever satisfied with God. Because it's always after something else more than God. It looks like faith. It looks like belief in God, but it's actually resistance to the will of God. It's a self-will kind of thing. It looks like wanting God, but it really is just wanting God for something else, for other things. So God knows that's exactly where Cain is, but he doesn't just leave him there. He doesn't slap him across the face and said, try better next time. He actually intercepts Cain because he sees Cain flowing down a really dangerous river. It says in verse 6, then the Lord said to Cain, and this is what God does all the time. Anytime he asks a question he already knows the answer to. He just wants you to have to hear your own answer. And so he asks Cain, why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what's right, will you not be accepted? It was time there for Cain to go, okay, what's right? I want to do that. I want to repent. I want to think rightly. I want to do rightly. But God knows he has to give a sterner warning, so he says this. Notice how he says this. This is the most graphic, some of the most graphic language in the Bible, descriptive-wise. But if you do not do what is right, sin, it's almost like it's a person, it's almost like it's a being. Sin is crouching at your door, and it desires to have you, but you must master it. See, Cain's kind of faith in God, Cain's transactional kind of faith, I want God for other things, more than I want God, but I want God for other things, was a sign that a spiritual predator was hiding inside his faith. Hiding inside his very view of God, his very relationship with God. And it hides in our ordinary feelings of self-pity and resentment and insecurity and jealousy and envy and lust and greed. And God warns, it's crouching at your door and it desires to have you. Listen to the language. It's like it has its life and a will of its own, and it wants you. It has a plan. It has a strategy. It's crouching at your door. It wants to sneak up on you. When we think of sin, we think it's something that we do. God says that's not it at all. Sin isn't something, really something that you do. Sin is something that does you. It's something, God says, that is crouching at your door and it desires to have you. It wants to master you. I wonder if this insight that's thousands of years old, because see, today people see the Bible as sort of this book of antiquity, this ancient story, this antiquated, outdated story that doesn't really relate to our modern lives. And yet, this insight about how these negative thoughts and emotions and attitudes work in our life, control our life, enslave our life, is so far ahead of our time. I think this ancient story with its insightful warning is something that even the most recent brain science is just now starting to catch up to. This brain science now, this science of neuroplasticity, in other words, because of the imaging technology we have, we can do MRIs, we can do PET scans of the brain, we're able to know now parts, we are able to study the brain now in ways that were impossible just a few years ago. So we can actually see in real time how things are actually, we used to think that your brain was just sort of hardwired, and the brain you had was the brain you had, and it turns out that's not it at all. The brain is constantly changing. It's constantly writing new neural pathways, and it's losing old pathways that aren't being used anymore. It turns out that the brain is constantly forming and transforming through repetition of certain things like experiences that we have, or experiences that we see others have, experiences that we observe, which might be really sobering of the kind of things that we might watch on TV or on the internet. Transforming and forming the very wiring of our brain. Our brain is being transformed, it's being formed, new pathways, neural pathways are being formed all the way through because of the things that were, new connection between brain cells and getting rid of old ones based upon the language that we use. The vocabulary that we hear or use. Words themselves can cause the brain to create new neural pathways. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will absolutely change my brain. I'd rather have broken bones. The power of thoughts. We've discovered that thoughts actually change brain structure. Every thought creates new neural pathways, actually shaping your brain to see and to respond to life in a certain way. I've been reading some books on this, fascinating books on this by neuroscientists, and one of them sort of had this footnote to a YouTube video, so I went off and watched it. I went down the rabbit hole, you know how that goes. And I started watching this YouTube video, and I started watching this documentary on this neuroplasticity, and there's this neurologist, neurological scientist who deals with neuroplasticity, and you could tell he's been sobered by all this. And he's making the point of how much that our thoughts, our very thoughts, he goes, what you think about is actually causing the brain to create new neural pathways. And the more repetitively and the more you think about something, it's actually building new neural highways in your brain. This guy named Dr. Alvaro Pascual Leon, he said this. He said he was talking and he said, he just, you could tell he was sobered by the discovery. He says this, you should be very careful about what you think about, because what you think about is how your brain is going to respond to life. It's creating your brain. It's reshaping your brain. It's rewiring your brain. In fact, this guy named Eric Kandel studied this, and he actually won a Nobel Prize for science for how the power of thought actually creates new neuronal synapses. It's a whole new science, but it's becoming something very sobering. Experiences, words, thoughts, always forming and transforming the very wiring of our brain. Now get this, the wiring of our brain determines how we see and interpret life, how we experience life, and how we view and how we experience God. The wiring of our brain. What we allow ourselves to think about is literally, and I mean literally, literally, forming and wiring our brain to see and think that way more and more. The blaming of others for our negative circumstances. Allowing ourselves to have thoughts of anger and resentment toward others and to continue to dwell on those repetitively. Our thoughts of the negative things that people have said to us and are playing that over and over in our mind. Our thoughts of self-pity and how we deserve better. Our thoughts of comparing ourselves to others who have it better, at least at this point in their lives. Our thoughts of jealousy and envy toward others' success or well-being. 1,000 other thoughts crouching at our door and wanting to master our entire lives, to enslave our entire lives by rewiring our brain. You have to ask yourself, what kind of brain am I becoming? Because you are constantly becoming in your brain. And God knew this, and God said this, and the Bible said this thousands of years ago. God says sin is crouching at your door, and it desires to have you, but you must master it. If God says the word must, that at least means to some degree that you can. I understand we live in a sinful life, a sinful world. Until heaven comes to earth, there's always going to be this reality of sin in our lives. But there is also a sense in which we can master to a large degree the wiring of our brain by having control, better control over our experiences, over our vocabulary, over our words, and over our thoughts. In fact, the New Testament says that the way we grow as a Christian is by the renewing, the transforming, the renewing of our mind, it says in Romans 12. In 2 Corinthians 10, it talks about taking every thought captive. This is how you live the Christian life. We can't be lazy in it. This is why God commands us to engage in personal worship and corporate worship. By repetition. Repetition of experience, repetition of language, repetition of thought. Not for ritual's sake. We're not jumping through hoops. We're not making transactions with God. I do this, he does that. That's not what it's all about. But for our formation and transformation. It turns out for our brain's formation and transformation, which we didn't know just 20 years ago, 10 years ago. Repetition of liturgy. The words that we say, phrases that we say, and how we say it that are building a narrative in our mind and rehearsing a narrative in how we see the world. Repetition in our singing, repetition in our praising, repetition in our meditation and our prayer through the Psalms. Like Psalm 16, it says, I say to the Lord, you are my Lord. I have no good apart from you. You make known to me the path of life. In your presence, there is fullness of joy. In your right hand, there are pleasures forevermore. Say that Psalm. Say those words. Meditate on those words every day for 30 days and see if you aren't building new wires in your brain that view God in a more realistic way. Repetition of the Lord's Prayer. Yeah, it's the Lord's Prayer that we're supposed to pray repetitively. And Jesus gave us the phrases for a reason. Repetition of communion, repetition of giving. Not because we're making a transaction with God, not because if I give, God will give. That's not it. But because we're doing the dedication thing. I'm saying this is a sign that I give my life to God. This is a sign of my trust and allegiance to Christ more than anything else. I'm not waiting to see how my finances are before I give. I want to give the first fruits. It's an act of repetitive worship that changes our brain because it re-narrates our life, forming and transforming our brain to see that the God who created everything is infinitely greater and infinitely better than anything else, infinitely more satisfying, infinitely more trustworthy, and infinitely more secure. In spite of what God said and the mercy in saying it, Cain didn't listen to God, and so rather than seeing sin as his real threat, instead he saw it as Abel. Verse 8, last verse we'll look at. Now Cain said to his brother Abel, let's go out to the field. I got a picnic basket with some sandwiches. While they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him. Now It's hard to be angry with God because you just can't win the fight. So like Cain, we look at the Abels of the world and we turn our frustration with God, we turn our dissatisfaction with God, we turn our anger toward God because we do and he doesn't. We didn't do what we expect. He's got a different plan. He's working on a different timeline. We're not going to understand it. He's the God that created this universe. He is infinitely greater than anything we can possibly imagine. But we get angry at God, but we can't fight God. We're going to lose that fight. And so instead, we turn to the Abels of the world and we turn our anger toward them. Resent them. Maybe it's our spouse, maybe it's our family, maybe it's our friends, maybe it's our church. Blame them, accuse them, slander them, mock them, get impatient with them, hate them, and we live a life of increasing isolation because we're mad at God, but we think we're mad at everybody, and we are because we're mad. A transactional faith doesn't work. It makes us unsatisfied with everything, especially God, because we want something else more than God. And the predator has snuck in right through our faith, right through our view of God. But Abel knew that the God who created everything is infinitely greater and better than anything else. So Abel died. You know, his story didn't turn out so well short term. We might say that he wasn't very satisfied the next day after his gift. He was dead. But, see, the thing is, he's part of this bigger story. To believe that the God who created everything else is infinitely greater, infinitely better, infinitely more satisfying, infinitely more trustworthy, infinitely more secure than anything else, you've got to believe that, repeatedly remind yourself that you yourself are in a much bigger story, not just this tiny story we see now each day with our eyes. In a strange kind of way, I was reminded of that reality when I saw this YouTube video. I don't spend that much time on YouTube. I'm sounding ridiculous today. But as I saw a YouTube video, you watch this just real quick, because it's one of these really kind of cool things. I always liked miniatures when I was a kid, you know, the HO sets and all that. You open this little electrical socket and you look, a little office in there. It's got a fridge, microwave, a little chair cracks me up. I got a chair just like that in my basement. We got a computer, kind of a 1980s office. Dinosaur on top of the computer. Looks like an office, but it's just a little miniature there, and it's really just, well, it's not much at all. But sometimes we get caught seeing our lives that way. this little world that's right in front of us, this little world that we can see with our and think about and analyze and evaluate the good and the bad with our little brains. And that's how we see life. And in that small little world, shrunk down to this little world, that's when a transactional faith actually makes sense to us. Not really wanting God, but wanting God to give us something else. Because in this little office we have, this little hole in the wall, this little shrunk down reality is all we think is real. And so our anger and our resentments and our cynicism and our insecurity and our jealousy and our envy, they make sense to us if all we see is this little shrunk down life and this little miniature world compared to the real big blue sky world of God's bigger story. So when Hebrews 11 talked about Abel, well, that's the chapter that talks about how everybody in chapter 11 was waiting for a better country. They were waiting for a new world whose architect and builder is God. That's the bigger story. This new kingdom of God that's going to renew everything on this world. We're not stuck in this little tiny hole in a light socket or an electrical socket. That's not what reality is. That's where resentment is. That's where the predator is. It hides in our faith. It hides in our view of God. It hides in our view of the world. It hides in our very tiny, shrunken picture of things that's not real. That's where the predator is. But understanding the story of Abel hopefully lets us know we don't want to ignore what God said. Be careful. Sin is crouching at your door, and it desires to have you, but you must master it. Don't let the predator drag you off and drag you away from the real story that counts. Amen.